Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Hello, David Hepworth here, welcoming you to a slightly unusual, somewhat self-promotional installment of Word in Your Ear. This is because I've just published a book called A Fabulous Creation, which is about the era of the long-playing record. And to launch it, we had an event at Foyle's excellent bookshop in Charing Cross Road, in front of an audience, and that meant Mark Allen and I got to transfer our usual crosstalk act across town to this new environment. So what you're going to hear is about 45 minutes plus questions about the book, A Fabulous Creation, and the LP record. We did it as usual with visuals, and so I hope you'll forgive anything that is not immediately clear. I'm sure you'll be acute enough to fill in the gaps. And, okay, here we go.
Where are we going, Dad? Where? Excellent. Very nice to see you. Thanks for coming.
I brought a present for everybody.
Marvellous.
He's got a present. He's got some records with him.
Yes, the long-playing record. Well, I was 15 years old when this came out. I don't know if anybody has a copy of this. It is unmistakably Frank Zappa's Hot Rats.
I bought it.
You bought it. Good. Good.
1972.
There we are. Okay. Well, yeah, I absolutely love this. This cost me a ruinous 34 shillings, which I think in those days you probably the same amount of money would have bought your Ford Anglia. It seems so incredibly expensive. They were so expensive records. And they were so expensive, but they were so precious. And they meant so much. And I absolutely loved and adored this record. And what I used to do, and I don't know if anybody else did this, it's embarrassing to share, isn't it? When I used to go out and see mates of mine, I would carry it with me down the street. Just literally carry it. Anybody else do this? I would carry the record with me. Excellent, Viv, you're here. See, I call this man Viv Stanchel for obvious reasons. And I would carry it with me because it used to. I felt it said something about me. I felt it said that I was hip, and that I was cool, and I was enigmatic, and that I was suffused with a raw animal sexual magnetism. And this point is taken up by our author tonight, and he brilliantly extends it on the back of the book here, where he says that albums become the mark of sophistication, a measure of wealth, an instrument of education, a poster saying things you dare not say yourself, a means of attracting the opposite sex, and for many, the single most desirable object in our lives. And I should imagine, actually, that part of the reason you're here is that you agree with him. He's never wrong. Please welcome David Hepworth. Tremendous. And Dave, this book is actually is dedicated to people who knew how it felt to carry an album down the high street. So give me an example of an album you might have carried.
I would probably have carried...
Probably Frank Zappa.
Hot Rats is a kind of classic case, isn't it? Because it's just an immensely confident-looking thing, isn't it?
It sends out a certain signal.
It sends out a signal, you know. I can remember first clapping eyes on that record in the unlikely environment of W.H. Smith's in Dewsbury, Yorkshire, during a vacation from college and thinking... That is an immensely cool thing. And so I was persuaded by the cover long before I was persuaded by the record, you know, or by the sound of it. And I think that's one of the things that I kind of wanted to get at in the book, you know, because, you know, my interest in music history, you know, I think I'm as interested in the history as I am in the music. And I'm interested in the history from the point of view of how people behaved with these things and around these things. And I think these are things that get lost in the kind of contemporary obsession with vinyl.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When you get young people, I don't know if anybody's ever had this, you get younger people come around to your house and go, you've got a lot of vinyls.
Your vinyls,
you think,
in the plural.
Where did that vinyls. Appalling expression come from?
Doesn't really matter what they are, just as long as they're on vinyl.
And right. Well, actually, our youngest daughter, sharing a flat in Clapton, recently said to me, have you got any spare vinyls? Because her flatmate had got a record player, but nothing to play on it. And so I actually, meanly, I said, no, I don't have any spare vinyls at
You're all.
You know, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
Get out there and get your own, you know. So, you know, that's what the book is about, you know. It's kind of LP culture and everything around it, you know. During that time when they were the single most, you know, valuable thing in our lives, it seemed.
Why did you choose to write it now, then? Is there any reason for that?
I don't know, really. I suppose it's only when a certain amount of time goes by that you're able to see kind of patterns in history,
yeah.
You know. And, you know, I've put a kind of term on it. You know, so my story of the LP starts in 1967, when everybody knows the LP goes back earlier than that, and it finishes in 1982, when everybody knows that the LP goes on longer than that. But I think that was the kind of... That was the prime period.
Well, it's self-evident. It will become self-evident as to why it ends in 1982. But it starts, obviously, with Sgt. Pepper. And you make the point that up till then, LPs have been sort of carriers, really. They were, you know, singles and a load of old rubbish. And
well, Phil Spector...
This was the first group that had made an album with no singles.
Yeah, I can remember when I first clapped eyes on this, actually. That's the actual copy. It's a mono copy. First clapped eyes on that in the window of a little record shop in Wakefield called the Record Bar, a tiny little place. And I was on my way home from school, and I used to go via the record shop just in case anything had happened, you know, anything new. You know, those were the days when I would literally go in this place every day it was open, you know, and flick through the new releases.
Because you didn't know. There was no news.
You didn't
know. You just go there and
I knew there was a new
record.
Beatles record yeah. coming, but I don't think I knew what I was looking for.
Yeah.
And there was this thing in the window, which kind of looked odd, you know. You hadn't seen anything like that before. And I rocked with surprise, you know, when I saw it. And I realised I had to have it that day, obviously. And by then it was 4:20 or whatever. And so I obviously didn't have enough money to buy it, because I think it was 32/6. And, you know, at that time, I could conduct an exhaustive, you know, audit of my worldly wealth by putting my hand
just
in my pocket.
Just putting your hand in your pocket, that's right. Having a feel around, that's right.
Or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I've got to have this record tonight. And so I got on a bus and went and urged this bus to go as fast as possible to where my father worked and threw myself on his mercy and said, if you give me the other pound, I'll work for you at the weekend or whatever it was. And then I raced back, got this, and went home. And, you know, and there, falling apart in my beak, is the original cover. And it took it home and put it on the record player. And I don't think it's any exaggeration to say it didn't come off for weeks. And one of the things that was immediately apparent when you looked at it was that there were very few divisions between the
tracks.
That's
right. You could tell straight away a lot of information about
away.
Just the shading of the vinyl.
I later on discovered when I worked at HMV in Oxford Street that in the classical department there used to be certain people who knew so much that they could look at a test pressing
and tell you what it was
of a new
by the
symphony,
bands.
And they could tell you, oh, it's Beethoven 7.
Well, I'd love to have gone for a pint with them. Really,
but you know,
thrilling.
this is a verse in lots of ways. I mean, you know, it's very difficult nowadays to look at that and get past all the millions
yeah.
of pastiches we've seen of it. But at the time, you looked at it and thought, that's absolutely extraordinary. And also, it was the first time you'd had the lyrics on the
lyrics
back.
Lyrics on the back. You talk very interestingly about all the kind of, if you like, the negative legacy of the Beatles in that because the Beatles wrote their own songs and because they had a concept album. Everybody thought they could do the same
thing. They all thought everybody
say a Satanic Majesty's Request. You got the Hollies did a record called Butterfly. There was Smiley Smile by the Beatles.
See, I think what people get wrong about Sgt. Pepper is this. Say, what made Sgt. Pepper amazing is it was adventurous.
Yeah.
It was experimental. No, it wasn't. The thing that made it amazing was it was so good. everybody went out and did experimental things.
Yeah, you call it shockingly appealing.
Witness the Rolling Stones, you know, the same summer.
Yeah.
Go in the studio and think, well, we can be amazing and experimental and dull, as everybody was to discover very quickly. Whereas the thing about that is it's an incredibly vibrant pop record.
Yeah.
All the way through. It's very up. It's very up-tempo all the way through. And, it still kind of surprises me to this day. So that was the kind of... That was the starting point.
When you start talking about, the effect of Sgt. Pepper, that's the first kind of long-playing record album. And then you make the point that various other things coincided with the new format, the LP, and one of them is the rise of the singer-songwriters. And there's lots of really fascinating reasons why the singer-songwriters suit the idea of the LP, don't they?
I think this record, which again is my kind of original copy, which I think has got sticker indicating it's stereo, because most of them were just mono at the time. And this became... I started college round about this time. And you used to go, if you were very fortunate, you'd be invited into the girls' hall of residence. So I'm talking late 60s here. And you go into somebody's study bedroom, and they're propped up against their little record player would be the songs of Leonard Cohen.
Bookends?
Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel. Possibly Al Stewart's
and
Love
Stewart
Chronicles.
Bed Scissor and Love Chronicles.
That was a pretty good signal. You might be
for the Tiller Man, maybe? I don't know.
Tea for the Tiller Man, possibly. And that these records sort of took the place of the slim volume of poetry.
That's true.
It was a sort of mark that you were... And don't forget, at this time, you had a sudden surge in people going to university. The baby boomers were all going to university.
College kids, the new audience. Yeah, kids
were an absolutely a vast market.
That's right, that was the equivalent of the battered paperback.
It was. It was, and again, you would carry it around, to show off how immensely soulful you were. And I was always intrigued by these guys, like Leonard Cohen and Paul Simon and Al Stewart and all these people, because they always wrote about how disastrous their love life was. And the rest of us...
But we're actually bragging about it.
Absolutely. We were all sitting there going, they've got a love life.
Al Stewart goes, well, there was Katie, and there was Jenny, and there was... And he goes, well, this goes on forever.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was all disastrous.
And that was the kind of pose, this has not been achieved without some expensive spirit, And we were all just immensely envious. And so, there's an important point in that record. That's every bit as much of triumph as packaging as anything else you might look at. What I mean? That it was the fact that he looked the way he did that went along with the way he sounded, that was all part of the new LP experience, Because you very often develop your interest in these things in the record shop. You just go in there and flick through.
And also, nothing about the LP was that the single tended to be... People bought singles because they liked the music. People bought albums because they liked the artist.
Absolutely.
And I think another significant thing is that people listen to them on headphones. I remember those records being listened to on headphones, and you developed an incredibly intimate relationship with the record and an understanding of the person who
although I have to say, one of my earliest experiences with headphones, I remember, in the early days of headphones, they always used to be as heavy as kind of the thing that an airline pilot would wear.
Yeah, that's right.
So your head would drop over. And I remember trying to excite my grandmother, who was probably born in the 19th century, with listening to Three Blind Mice from 10 Years After Stonehenge.
Oh, God, yeah. And, well, what a terrible record that was.
Absolutely awful record.
Did you buy that?
I bought that record.
Yeah, yeah.
I bought that record. And
else buy Stonehenge? You're lucky.
And the stereo would pan across so that, as the drums went across. Yeah. And she was not wildly impressed.
No, not at all. No. Now, where are we? The samplers were a big thing. I can remember so vividly, the Rock Machine Turns You On, Fill Your Head With Rock, Nice Enough to Eat.
Who bought this?
They were brilliant records, and they were less than half the price of a...
It's a 15 bob, I think, something like that.
Yeah.
Compiled by a guy called David Howells, who I spoke to for the book. And, this is the reason that nearly everybody of a certain age can sing Fresh Garbage by Spirit.
That's right.
You know.
Yeah. And you that's know, how a lot of them discovered Leonard Cohen, actually.
That's how they discovered Leonard Cohen. You know, it had Sisters of Mercy on there. You know, because don't forget, at the time, people like Leonard Cohen or anybody who made albums wouldn't get written about anywhere. You know, the NME and the Melody Maker weren't really into that kind of thing at all. And certainly weren't going to play it on the radio. You know, you might have had, you know, Radio 1 that started in 1967, but it didn't really do this kind of thing at all. It was still half of what they did was Radio 2. And so this was an attempt to find a completely new way of galvanising this new kind of rock audience, you know. And that's the interesting thing to me about The Rock Machine Turns You On, is that you could chuck under it, under that, you know, umbrella, all kinds of things. You can have Tim Rose,
folk,
you can have Blood, Sweat and Tears.
Songwriters,
anything as rock.
Rock,
you know, because once you had this kind of new audience. This
alternative new, underground.
These people who thought themselves, and we were all like that, you know, we thought of ourselves as sophisticated.
Yeah. There's a huge amount devoted, quite rightly, to covers of albums, how important they are. And it's really interesting, you look at sort of things like Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys, and that was just part of marketing rather than creative. The Beach Boys made a record and think, oh, God, we need a cover. Well, look, somebody just go off on a rainy afternoon to a zoo somewhere and take a picture of them with some goats, and that'll do, you know. Whereas this was part of the creative, wasn't it? This is part of the whole concept of the album.
This is extraordinary. This was designed by a guy called Barry... Well, illustrated, done by a guy called Barry Godber, who's a friend of the band. First album by King Crimson came out in 1969.
This is In the Court of
In the Court of the Crimson King. Yeah. Full title, An Observation.
An Observation by King Crimson. Not pretentious at all.
Boy, we were. and he did that by, apparently he just got the shaving mirror and opened his mouth, you know, and painted himself, you know, somehow. And this sold records on its own.
Incredible.
You know, I talked to Bruce.
Every record shop put it in the window, didn't they?
Ireland just issued, you know, loads of spare covers. You know, you could put them throughout your shop window, and the records just walked off the shelf.
Yeah.
You know, everybody bought that record, even if you didn't like it.
Yeah, you liked the idea of it.
You liked the idea of it. Yeah. It's quite interesting to go and read back the reviews of that record, because clearly the reviewers didn't really know whether they liked it or not.
But they felt obliged to.
They had to say it's immensely impressive.
Yeah,
it's, you know,
it's intriguing.
It's the ultimate album.
Right. Yeah,
all the things that people say when they're not quite clear, but. This came out at the same time, you know, the first band album, and
second band album.
And
I just couldn't let that go. I wouldn't have been able to get to sleep tonight if I.
You wait till I get you home. and the interesting thing to me was, I remember I bought that King Crimson record, but I also bought that.
Yeah.
Came out about the same time.
Yeah.
You know, because if you were interested in rock, you were interested in all kinds of stuff, you know, whether it was kind of rootsy, what people would nowadays call Americana or God knows what, or whether it was King Crimson at the other end.
But the picture has such an... colours your impression of the music.
And if you know, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the first band album, which is one of Bob Dylan's less... appealing
sketches.
Doors.
Yeah.
And whereas that, you know, they just line them up on a road near Woodstock on a rainy day, and somehow magically, it reminds me of, I don't know if people are familiar with the photographs of Matthew Brady that he took during the American Civil War. It echoes that kind of look, you know. And so they look like men.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't look like, you know, 2 years earlier, everybody had been wearing scoop neck T-shirts and flares and Kensington Market loons. And suddenly these guys appear to be coming out of a totally different world. And again, the photograph grounds the record completely.
Yeah, and completely colours your view. You make the point that it's almost cinematic, you know, that it's got as much imagination in that music.
It is.
Writing about the Civil War, they're writing about the 19th century.
It's a movie, that record.
Yeah, yeah.
Although you're the person who always tells me that you've never listened to side two.
That's right. This is, that's very sweet that you mentioned that in the book, actually. I only ever listened to side one, because when I listened to side one of that record, I thought it was so perfect, I couldn't bear to turn it over in case the second side wasn't as good.
Yeah.
So I refused to listen to it. This is another one. This is the record you say, A, this is the first upmarket rock group, which is a really good point. I never thought of that, actually. And B, this is the first album that was made by its cover. I mean, the cover really did
sell. It always strikes me like
that. Yeah, absolutely.
It's 1972.
Yeah, this is the first Roxy Music album.
It's the first Roxy Music album. And, you know, which I still... This is controversial. I still don't think it's all that good a record. But it's a brilliant package.
Plenty of time to fight with David afterwards.
It's an unbelievable package. You know, because... That record has done the selling before you've got to it. And nobody had seen anything like that at the time. And don't forget, at the time, there's very little colour in the magazines or newspapers that you read. You know, you weren't as conversant with images as we are now.
Yeah.
You know? That was kind of revolutionary to do something like that. And, you know, it was Brian Ferry who had the concept, but it was Anthony Price and various people in the Royal College of Art and whatever. You know, they got in the professionals and they got a proper model who I think was paid £15 for her services that day. And it became the start of everything that Roxy Music were. And so everything they did afterwards had to echo that idea.
And the start of the idea of listening to some extent with your eyes, wasn't it? Did you think?
I would have thought so.
Because I remember seeing that record and thinking, I want to know what this group looks like. Whereas if you heard the Groundhogs or, you know, Rory Gallagher or something, it didn't really matter what they looked like.
And we were seeing the Groundhogs, you were
quite sorry you had seen them.
Pretty clearly.
That's true. It's that start, the start of the idea of music being a partly visual thing.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
But, yeah.
Sorry.
Yes.
This is an interesting...
I just thought this is interesting, you know, that George Orwell's 1984, you know, if you are the publisher of George Orwell's 1984, every 5 years or whatever, you repackage 1984, supposedly for a modern audience.
Yeah.
Different way of looking at... There's no doubt somebody doing it for Trump 1984.
Yeah.
They're probably doing that at the moment. So 1984, the appearance of it changes absolutely all the time. And we're perfectly all right with that. Nobody changes that.
Nobody would ever change it and never change
it. Nobody would dream of changing that. Ever.
It's absolutely sacrosanct, isn't it?
It's completely sacrosanct. You know, that is...
Shows you what an important part of the package is.
That moment in time, you know. That's what we are drawn to.
Yeah. You talk about the new format and you talk about the new variety of music that suits that format, but you also talk about the new audience, heads, as you call them. And there's an example of two heads here, both taken at the age of... How old were we? 20, I think.
I was 21.
Yeah. I sent that picture of Dave not so long ago, the one on the right, I'm afraid, says me, and he said, I'm expecting you to burst into the opening of Dream a Little Dream of Me, which I thought was incredibly unkind thing to say. But anyway, I've got over it now.
I put these on Twitter the other day and somebody said, don't fancy yours.
Oh, right! That's brilliant. But it's an interesting thing that there was a whole new audience of people, heads, as you call them, you know. How would you describe heads? Who were we?
I suppose they were generally, they were long-haired people who lived for records. That's all they wanted to do. They lived for records and going to gigs. And, you know, it's... I keep coming back to this, that, you know, that if you... Nowadays, if you're a young person... And you want to look fashionable, you have to invest in certain brands or, you know, certain clothes or whatever. All you had to do in 1971 was nothing at all.
Nothing at all. You just had to sit in a chair and will your stubble to extend
itself. Just let it grow.
That's right,
you know?
Yeah.
And hair was so important. You know what I mean?
Crucial.
I can't tell you.
And the longer it was, the more countercultural you had been.
And
the more against the system, the longer.
And you know, you'd get on a tube train and you'd see people with kind of similar hair.
Yeah.
And there would be a little bit of an exchange of...
Bond immediately.
Flicker of recognition, wouldn't there? And, you know. And, And so...
But weren't those people marketed to brilliantly? Don't you think? You think those record companies, you know, the man can't bust our music.
Well,
kind of brilliant way that they rounded up all people like us and, and to some extent exploited our gullibility,
Well, we're all students and we all just love the idea of being against the man.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, the man was representing CBS Records or whatever.
Yeah.
But the... I talk quite a bit in the book about the kind of the equipment that playing records.
Well, you move into a flat in North London in about 1971, and everyone's got their bedrooms and all that, and you've got the biggest room in the house across the front is called the sounds room. Is that right? No, hint of irony.
These are friends of ours lived in Finsbury Park at the time, and in quite a big knackered old
place. Yeah.
And they had a room at the front upstairs that went the width of the building, pretty much. And they used to refer to that reverentially as the sound room.
And we had the same thing. You would go into those rooms and would put on the record.
The only thing in the sound room, enormous room, would be... Probably there was a carpet. I mean, it can't be entirely joke. But there would be, you know, in the centre of the room, there would be the hi-fi.
Yeah.
You know, somebody's... lovingly assembled, collection of separates, which was judged better than anybody else in the house.
Yeah.
And then there would be a few kind of uncomfortable scatter cushions and maybe a knackered old sofa. And we would go, my wife and I, you know, but we weren't married in those days, and what are you doing Saturday night? Oh, we're going round to Stephen Carroll's. We're going to listen
to Crosby, Stills and Nash.
That's what we're going to do.
I know.
That's what we could turn up there with a bottle of cider or a few cans or a bottle of Hirondelle rough red wine.
Yeah.
And you listen to the new Van Morrison album.
Yeah.
It was your evening's entertainment. And you were completely happy with that. And what interests me when I go back, I was reminded of this when I was looking at Elvis Costello's book, his autobiography, where he talks about when he's living, I think he's in Flip City before he becomes Elvis Costello, and he's living in, he's sharing a flat somewhere in London with a bunch of guys, and they used to take it in turns to DJ for each other, you know, so you'd be able to play three records and everybody else would listen.
Wonderful.
And he says, I don't even remember if we had a television. And I don't even remember whether we had a television. I lived in a flat at one point that had no home comforts whatsoever, but it had four record players.
Yeah. But that's a really interesting point, because if you think of all the other distractions that came along later, comedy is one of them. Comedy was still something that belonged to your parents' generation, with Stanley Baxter and
Walkman
and Wise, you know. And the movie industry really didn't get going in a blockbuster way.
No, the movie industry
until the
gets
1970s.
Going with Star Wars.
Yeah, got going in the 70s.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, and so there weren't those other options. There weren't those other entertainment options, you know.
No, not
such
at all.
An important thing.
And also, this really important point is that if you wanted to listen to music, you had to go home to do it.
Yeah.
So I write in the book about one of my flatmates, Stuart, who used to have a, you know, soul-crushing job as a clerk in the government organisation. And he used to just store up the frustration, you know, all day. And then at the end of the day, you'd have to get on the tube, and the tube would be full of people smoking and stinking and God knows what, you know, reading the Evening Standard. And then he'd get all the way home, come up to the flat, and I could hear him in the room next to me, and I could hear this click as he turned on the record player and turned up the volume as far as he could, and then lowered the stylus onto Tres Hombres by ZZ Top.
Top. That's right, yeah.
And you'd hear this whole building.
It was kind of like a spiritual bath, right?
Yeah. But the reason he did that is because he had no access to that sensory experience.
Yeah.
Any other way?
The only way you get loud music was at home, wasn't it?
You couldn't, you know, you couldn't put on headphones and listen on your way home.
Yeah.
So it made it a very charged thing.
So there's lots about record shops in the book, which is absolutely fascinating. And this whole thing, I'm sure you've all seen High Fidelity, but the Jack Black character in that's brilliant, where he's working in the record shop. And he suddenly decides he's not going to sell his beef art bootleg. He just feels he's not going to do it. Somebody comes in at one point and orders a Lion, asks if he's got a Lionel Richie record. He says, oh, is this for somebody in a coma?
Stevie Wonder.
Oh, is it Stevie Wonder, was it? Are they in a coma? I remember that, you know. And he's so snobbish. And that thing I remember so distinctly about record shops at that time is that the people who ran them hated the idea that you knew something that they didn't know. Do you remember that? Where you'd go and say, have you got so-and-so record? They'd kind of pretend it didn't exist.
I was always, you know, that time I was on the other side of the counter.
That's what you were.
I was one of those unpleasant people.
Yeah.
And there's two things, two kinds of...
You probably served me.
I probably did. Probably sent you off the flea in your ear. You know, and there's two kinds of customer that you didn't like. You didn't like customers who knew nothing.
Yeah.
And you didn't like customers who knew something.
Knew everything. Yeah.
You know, because it's very important that you behind the counter were clearly the high priest who knew more than anybody else. But it was, you know, it was an immensely educational time for me working in a record shop, because what you realise, and it's a thing I refer to still nowadays, people say, oh, you know a lot about music. I say, when you know a lot about music, all you know is how much you don't know. You know, because you go and work in a big record shop.
Yeah.
You're working alongside people who know more than you do.
Yeah.
Or know different from you do. And that's an immensely educational thing. And it's also given me, you know, a great deal of respect for how records become hits and the kind of things that get people's enthusiasm. And also how various people are. I'll tell you what I was thinking about earlier today. When I worked in HMV, we used to get, after Christmas, people would bring back things they'd been given for Christmas, you know. They didn't want them, or they were faulty or something. And I never forgot, a few days after Christmas, this young woman came in and she said, I got this for Christmas. And I played it on Christmas morning and it scratched. I was so disappointed. And I said, give me the bag. And I opened it. It was The End, my Nico. And I thought to myself, my God, Christmas morning?
Yeah. Yeah. Happy Christmas. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just going in the room to listen
enjoy.
To this doomy harmonium music. You know, dear, but you know, that's people are like that.
It was a lovely bit where you took back your copy of Amagama. You just didn't like
it. I've got this here, actually. There we have Pink Floyd's Amagama. Comes out, I don't know, 1970, 69 or something like that. And we thought it was immensely impressive at the time because it's got a picture
of
all their equipment lined up on, you know, Biggin Hill Aerodrome, I think. Nowadays, there are buskers performing round the corner with more equipment than they had there. And I did something that I really did, which is I took this record home. And there was nobody in at home. So I didn't have to go through the thing you normally went through when you took a record home, which was your flatmates or your family or whoever would say, what's that? And you'd go, oh, it's amazing. Yeah. I've just got the new Sansa or whatever, you know. So I was on my own. So I played this record, all four sides. And at the end of the fourth side, I looked to myself in the mirror and said to myself, you don't like this, do you? You never will like this, will you? And so I rang the record shop and said, I bought this record and I don't like it.
Can I bring it back?
Can I throw myself on your mercy? Because I thought, otherwise I'm going to be stuck with this damn thing. And you couldn't afford to be stuck with anything. And so they said, yeah, bring it back. And so I went and I bought that instead. Legion Leaf by Fairport Convention.
Very, very good.
Still
investment.
One of my favourite records.
Surely good
this
investment.
Day. And every time I look at it, I think, it's a great record, but look what it delivered me from.
Yeah.
As well.
Get away from the Pink Floyd. Yeah. Oh, here are the Pink Floyd again. My goodness. Well, we could talk about this, but there are many other things to talk about. But just briefly, you talk about The Dark Side of the Moon as being the absolute kind of apex of a long-form format, isn't it? And a lot of it's to do with the fact that people were such good listeners. People made music for people who were prepared to put in hours and hours and hours of listening to the different layers of sound and invention.
Yeah, well, I think there was this push towards long-form. There had always been this. Because don't forget, go back to the invention of the long-playing record. You know, it's invented in 1948. as a way to get a whole of a symphony on a record, on two sides of a record. Because prior to that, you'd had a pile of 78s, and you'd have to, you know, change them every 4 minutes. And they used to sell them in leather wallets called albums, hence the expression
the name,
album today. And so there'd always be, post Sergeant Pepper, there'd always been this idea that rock really should be moving towards long form, you know. So this is the same year as Mike Oldfield's Tubular Bells, which was, you know, it was the triumph of long form over content, you know what I mean? It's kind of a bit dull, but it goes on for a little while, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Got to give him points for keeping going.
Your stamina.
And, you know, we were talking about this earlier. You know, what's the only bit of Michael Oldfield's Tubular Bells that we look forward to?
Viv Stanchel.
It's when our friend Viv Stanchel pipes up.
Here he is. He's here.
There at the end.
Yeah.
And counts off the instruments, you know. Yeah. So it began, but at the time, people so wanted it to be true, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, people invested so much emotion in Dark Side of the Moon.
They did, incredibly. Just very briefly, this is a fantastic... The whole chapter about Donna Summer, and a lot of which I just didn't know, just how much that affected the music market and how that changed the way records were made.
Well, this fellow was working in a record shop, and this guy came in from the Middle East. He used to run a disco in the Middle East, and he used to come in and buy hundreds of records once a year. And then, when he come in on this occasion and I'd given him a load of records and piled up and so forth, he said to me, "Have you got any sex music?" And I thought, well, you don't have a section called that, so I think you know. But this was what he was talking about, you know, because this was the big thing in the discos, you know, which was a piece of music, you know, the main virtue of which was it went on for a long time, you know. And Neil Bogart is the record mogul who signed it.
It sustained a particular mood.
He said, "I want it long enough to soundtrack an orgy." You know,
yeah.
I think he was showing off.
Yeah.
And but I think it's a real point of departure. This record, because whereas Sergeant Pepper and so forth had all been about variety and range, this wasn't. This was about mood.
Yeah, mood and sustaining that mood.
Sustained mood.
Yeah.
It's the idea that that's what a record is there to do.
Yeah.
It's to change
completely
the mood in the room.
Purpose.
And Mike Lee's Abigail's Party, which is written round about this time and receives its first performance at Hampstead Theatre, I think, and then later on goes on television. It starts with the terrifying Beverly, as she called, I think, played by Alison
Steadman. Yeah.
coming on stage. Lighting up a large cigarette
martini.
And putting on a record. And what is it? It's Love to Love You, Baby. You know, it's the idea that this can transform even the most, you know, kind of unpromising suburban
and starts
house.
The whole world of kind of ambient dance music.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a bit at the end where you talk about two records, both actually trying to achieve the same thing, really. They're both by two different artists, and they're both trying to produce the right situation creatively to produce the most successful and big selling record they possibly can. One is Fleetwood Mac making Tusk, and one is Michael Jackson making Thriller. And the two methods could not be more different, could they?
Well,
Fleetwood Mac, you know, spend millions of pounds renting studios and trying at one point, they were even thinking of trying to replicate Lindsay Buckingham's bathroom.
Yeah.
Because that's where he felt most creative, going to build a version of his bathroom.
Well, it's a classic case of what happens in the music business. They spent a fortune on building studios and so forth. And then as soon as they went in there, he wanted to record on an old boombox.
That's right.
Because that got the kind of a raw sound that he wanted.
Yeah.
And it took him a year to record and cost millions of dollars. And eventually the story of Tusk becomes the story about how much money they spent on it. And it didn't sell anything like the earlier records. But it's a fantastic record.
Mm.
But it's kind of awkward as all get out, that record. If you go and listen to it now, it starts with a really down-tempo song. It's not kind of front-loaded with hits or anything like that.
Yeah.
It's not engineered for the market.
Yeah.
It's a kind of two fingers to the market, really. And then the contrast that with Thriller, Michael Jackson, you know, where the idea was...
Calculated record imaginable, isn't it?
You know, the first day of recording, you know, that album, Quincy Jones announced to the rest of them, we're here to save the music business. Because this had come along just after disco, you know, had peaked and gone away. And the high point of the LP record is 1976-77. If you look at the sales, in terms of total sales. Whereas they thought there was an opportunity to do something very, very calculated. And there's nothing about Thriller that wasn't very, very
Everything's a crossover market, isn't it?
Everything's...
There's a track with Paul McCartney, there's a track with Eddie Van Halen.
I want a track that sounds like My Sharona by the Knack.
Exactly.
No, it's got yeah. And it's going to have... It's going to one of these three yeah. white guitarists are going to play a... You know, a solo on yeah. it. It's massively calculated. It's immensely successful,
and it's sold by video. And you make the point that this changes people's at MTV. The arrival of MTV changes people's relationship with music. It becomes a soundtrack to a
it's an audio-visual experience.
Yeah. So
totally different,
and it starts to rob people of their imagination. The imagination that you would have used listening to Legion Leaf or whatever. You know, once you see something illustrated. Yeah, it's completely different.
It's all there.
So it ends with there's the MTV, there's the arrival of the VHS, which is really interesting because that again suddenly people are not listening to the sounds room.
Well, see,
it's probably got another device.
Prior to the VHS,
people are watching Kramer versus Kramer. You know,
prior to the VCR. The only machine in your house that could replay something was the record player.
Yeah.
That was very exciting to be able to do that. As soon as you could do it with telly, that's just immensely exciting to most people. And it completely takes over people's lives. And then,
the Walkman.
So the Walkman, you know, no longer is music tethered in your room. Two things with the Walkman. One, you can make your own compilations, which loads of people did. They customised music. They liked that feeling of power. And two, you take it around with you. You know, you look at all the films from the early 80s. You know, what are people doing with a Walkman? They're roller skating, aren't they?
Suddenly, well, once you're wearing a Walkman, there seems to be no point in just sitting in a chair. You might as well go. So it becomes, music becomes a kind of soundtrack to an activity.
It's like you're the star.
You're on the tube.
Rather than
you're
the music. You
know? Exactly.
So I think those things change it. So that's where I think you get the end of the era of the LP. And then not far away, you've got the arrival of the CD. And the CD, although we thought it was like the LP record, it wasn't at all.
It wasn't at all.
You know, how is it that these things, you know...
Just don't have the magic. Also, you couldn't see it revolve.
You couldn't see it more than the records, you know. How is it we have no emotional attachment to that whatsoever? But we do,
During the course of writing the book, you went back and... Exactly. You went back and listened to, and the book ends with the 15, 16 years, I think it is, that you talk about. You talk about 10 albums that you went back and listened to, and you talk about how you felt about them when you first heard them, and how you feel about them now.
Well, I listened to all of them, you know.
We've got 10 of them here. Take the clicker.
These are 10.
Run us through.
These are 10.
You'll have time for a few
questions. I'm not saying the greatest records ever made or anything like that, but, you know, just... 10 striking records.
Yeah.
Van Morrison Moondance, second album. It's wonderful to me because it illustrates how a miss is as good as a mile, you know? He's tried to make that record another 30 times since. Can't do it. You know, what makes remarkable records is just a magic that happens at a time, you know? And you can't go back and do it again. And you go and listen to Moondance, it's mind-boggling.
It's fantastically good.
How good it is. Yeah. How simple it is.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan, John Wesley Hardy, it's still my favourite Bob Dylan record, I think, made the same year as Sgt. Pepper.
Yeah. Going in completely the opposite direction.
Completely the opposite direction. And, you know, what's the cover picture? You know, him and the kind of local handyman and the balls of Bengal. And there's been no explanation
about it.
Somebody's
hat at the bottom. Yeah.
I don't like cool David Bowie. I like uncool David Bowie. I love that because he was floundering around. He was trying absolutely everything. He was writing songs for Pete and Noon. He was
the Beauty
doing
Brothers.
His Andy Warhol song. Absolutely everything. It's still my favourite David Bowie record. I remember the Ramones album.
This is a bit of a comedy when it came out.
I remember playing that in the shop. And the great thing about the Ramones' first album was it was a joke at the expense of the LP. You know, you listen to it, And it's the first track went, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1:30 or whatever. Yeah. And then the second track started, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. He thought, they can't keep doing this. Yeah. And they did
and
keep
they did.
Doing this.
They do.
And also, was there ever a better statement of who we are than the cover of that
picture's fantastic.
And again, you can't do it again.
Yeah.
You know, nothing you do afterwards is as good. I love Donald Fagen's The Nightfly. I love Steely Dan, but I love this even more. It's a bit of a story record, you know, based on his youth growing up in the suburbs during the Kennedy era. I love that cover. I love the record.
The whole romantic idea of the late night DJ. Like an American graffiti. It's fantastic, isn't it?
And now when I look at the records that I play most often, the first Burning... Well, it's not the first Burning Spear. It's the first Island Burning Spear record. It's the driest reggae record imaginable. But I play it far more than Bob Marley or anything like that. I've come to admire enormously those Grace Jones records that she made for Island in the... When are we talking about? In the 80s, produced by Chris Blackwell, done at Compass Point, where, you know, really interesting range of material. And
incredible records, dub on it, soul.
You wouldn't say Grace Jones had remarkable musical talent, but it just works.
Yeah, it's an incredible combination.
The second Joy Division album, you know, some records become immortal, you know, some records have immortality thrust upon them, you know. And this, when Ian Curtis died between the completion of the record and the release of the record, which no doubt just increased its mystique massively. But, you know, the two that I still hold up as the kind of apogee of the kind of sophisticated, long-playing record. If ever anybody had any hope that the long-playing record could be like the novel, Randy Newman's Good Old Boys and Joni Mitchell's Court and Spark, which both came out the same year, both by, you know, Americans round about the same age. Randy Newman's about the South, the southern states of America, and I've spent the subsequent 40 years realizing how true that record is. And it's only when Donald Trump's in the White House.
Yeah, the Lester Maddox story.
You realise how true that record
Absolutely.
Is.
Absolutely.
And Back nobody would dare to even think what that record's about nowadays, let alone record it. There was not a record company in Britain or in America that would put that record out nowadays. And finally, Court and Spark, because I think it's an immensely sophisticated record about what people will and will not do for love. But it's also a pop record. You put it on, and you do the housework.
And all those other musicians were so envious of how talented she was. Suddenly discovered she could do jazz as well.
Well, she could do anything.
Yeah.
And but it's a useful pop record as well as a piece of art, because I actually think the art's quite easy.
Yeah.
That's the challenge of the LP, is to be the pop record as well as the art. So those are mine. My 10. If you ask me again tomorrow, I'll give you another 10.
Another 10. This whole section is at the end of the book, and it's absolutely brilliant. 160 records reviewed very, very briefly as to whether or not they still stand up, you know. But look, we've got time for about 10 minutes worth of questions. If anybody has any questions, I say 10 minutes, I put you under a lot of
pressure. I think we've answered people's questions.
So, well, Viv Stanton, we'll start with Viv.
Oh, a microphone. Once again, a fantastic book, David. I can't wait to read it.
What a review. Fantastic, but can't wait to read it.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, we should have more reviews like that.
What was I going to say?
Sorry.
You haven't mentioned how important it was and obsessive to keep your records clean and immaculate. Because that was the thing that you had to do. I was saying earlier to my mate Mike, I'd come home and my mum would have played something, Perry Como probably, taken it off the turntable and leant it up against the side of the unit.
Naked record?
Yeah, absolutely ballistic. Now, in honour of your great book, I have got for you a vintage Emitex cleaner.
Yes!
Oh, lovely.
How very kind.
Oh, that's great.
Is that for me?
Oh, I remember
that
so
well. Thank you very much, Viv. Look at that. I'll take that home and, you know, it does for use with vinyl plastic microgroove records only.
That's it.
So I won't waste it on my 78.
The fragility of records, if you scratch them or you've got a jump in them, you just change your relationship with the record. You couldn't quite look at it the same way again.
Yeah, absolutely. My copy of the band, I think across the Great Divide, it jumps on across the
Great
Divide.
And then when you hear it on
a
record,
if I hear it on the CD now, I think something's wrong.
Oh.
It's you, not sir. Jumping.
Yeah, David, you talk about in the book this thing about the time that we haven't got now to listen to albums. Do you ever...
Hello. Do you ever sit down and listen to an album all the way through? And if not, why not?
Yeah, I do. Well, I did it while writing this book, you know, because for the section at the end of the book, as Mark said, you know, I did it. You kind of have to make yourself do it. I went through a period where I used to do it on a Saturday morning. Somehow Saturday morning just seemed the right time to do it. And I used to post a Tumblr about it called Platter Day. Yeah.
Saturday Platter Day, wasn't it? That's right.
Saturday Platter Day. But, you know, it's very difficult nowadays because you just have so many choices. And I think there's no getting away from it. We're very twitchy. It's, you know, when you engage with any kind of media nowadays, you tend to do it with one hand on the button that can take you away from it.
Yep. And the moment you get bored...
Imagine watching Netflix without that there.
Yeah.
You think, oh, God, no.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to have to watch whatever comes along, you know. You kind of expect control, you know. And that's the kind of... It's the iPod experience, the smartphone experience is that, isn't it?
Completely.
You know? I flick around all the time. But, you know, that's one of the points that I make in the book, that you were prepared to put in the time because one of the reasons was there wasn't that much else. You know, that's not damning those things at all. And also, you know, I'm talking about, I don't know, 1974, 1975. I had a lot of records. What was a lot of records? 300? Nowadays, somebody with a lot of records... It's Danny Kelly.
Yeah, Danny Kelly.
Or whatever, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's people who move houses, move
40
countries.
Of those are Marquee Moon by television.
Danny Kelly always claims that he liked Marquee Moon by television so much that when he used to find records in second-hand bins or whatever, when the CD came out and people were getting rid of their old vinyl, he would buy them. Until he
took find a good home for.
Yeah, about 40 of them.
That's right, he did.
And used to give them to people. You know? That's what he says.
Another question. Anybody else? I can't see. Yes, that, absolutely, in the middle there. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you too.
Fascinating, David and Mark. Just wanted to ask you about what, I don't know if it's the right word, the antecedents or outliers of some of the those very striking album covers that you describe later in the 60s. When I'm 55 now, and I remember my parents, in not a very big record collection, having Beyond the Fringe. I don't know if anybody remember that. And that was, what, 1961, something like that? But in later life, as a teenager, in the era of punk and new wave, I remember looking at that again, and love it. I loved it, still do, and thinking, they're a band. You know, the way it's all shot, it's sort of still a little bit before the Beatles.
Right,
those first CDs. And if you look at the original LP, the whole thing is they are marketed. You know, it's like they've got their little bios. So, like, Dudley Moore likes girls and salt, dislikes being beaten up.
Yeah.
You know, it's fantastic, but it seems way ahead. And I just wonder if you come across...
I've written in the book quite a bit about comedy records fascinate me. Because I remember being obsessed with Bob Newhart's driving instructor on the cruise of the USS Codfish and all these. And Bob Newhart was... You know, it was a person that Warner Brothers found completely by accident and saved Warner Brothers records. And the person who was leading in this in comedy records in the UK was, of course, the great George Martin. George Martin recorded Flanders and Swan, which we all Love Flanders as one. And recorded Beyond the Fringe, I think. But also, he was the person who realised, way ahead of his time, that he could make a funny record with Peter Sellers without an audience. And so if you go and listen to Songs for Swinging Sellers, these are masterpieces, these records. And I often think that when Sergeant Pepper came along 6 or 7 years later, the antecedents of it were songs for Swinging Sellers. It was the idea of being able to make an experience, a transporting experience, having learned all that in comedy records. And, of course, I think it's very sad that we don't have comedy records anymore because there's sort of no need for them, you know. Comedy nowadays comes to you in a million bits and pieces absolutely all the time.
Got those private eye flexi discs, you can remember those so vividly.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And it's also, it used to be a social thing, you know, that people would invite people round to listen to a comedy record.
You couldn't listen to a comedy record on your own.
You couldn't do it.
Yeah, it was
a comedy record. It's a very tense moment, you know, you invited people round to listen to your whatever it was, you know. National Lampoon Lemmings.
Yeah.
And if they didn't like it, if they weren't laughing, you know,
wasn't
it was a long
evening.
Way until the record was
there. It's a very difficult
evening. You couldn't flick it over.
I know. You had a question, I think, yeah.
I just wanted to say that I am 54 and I should have lived all of the stuff that you guys constantly talk about.
Drone on about
it. I have been such a monumental square. I lived out in the country and never went to anything. My claim to fame is I did actually see the wall at Earl's Court, and that's about it. But all of my appreciation of music and enjoyment of music has actually come from you two idiots. Just purely.
It's second hand.
And it's not it's not been so much about the specific tunes, it's been about the appreciation of it and the observations of it, and you spending half your life going to gigs and you not going to so many gigs, but certainly talking about it. And I have enjoyed music as much as anybody has, purely about, like, sitting here listening to it and learning about it through that, rather than being the person.
Because
I was a terrible fraud.
Very,
never
very, very sweet
any
you say
of
that.
But
thank you very much.
It.
What can we do for you, sir?
What can we do for you? We've got time for one more, I think, and then Dave will be available to sign books. Carry on.
Fascinating. Loved it. What's interesting for me is I grew up with the Smash Hits era, where I was introduced to you guys. And you don't really see pop albums of the kind of late 70s, early 80s in your 10. I mean, I'm sure there's some maybe in your wider. What's your thoughts on the pop albums of those that era? Because a lot of people think of it the singles era rather than the album era.
I think it was. You know, I've written quite a bit in the book about things like Parallel Lines, you know, Blondie, and in television, Marquee Moon and so forth. I think there was something about that kind of music that lent itself to a kind of short hits rather than luxuriating in the kind of protracted, relatively sensual experience of listening to Joni Mitchell or, you know, Neil Young's After the Gold Rush or whatever. It's a kind of different state of mind. But, you know, there are things like Elvis Costello's first albums and things like Ian Dury's New Boots and Panties, I still think is a masterpiece, an absolute masterpiece. And again, like Randy Newman's Good Old Boys, imagine that being done today. Just imagine.
With the front page of the Daily Mirror, wouldn't it?
Well, no, it wouldn't even get that
far. It wouldn't be released.
It wouldn't get that far. You say you can't do that.
No, you can't.
You can't do anything as strange as that. And the great thing about, you know, final point, really, about the LP, and, you know, hats off to the record business, because everybody always says, oh, these people would have done amazing things if only the Suits had let them. The Suits did let them.
They did.
They let them do what they want.
Yeah.
Because
and lost huge amounts of money.
New Boots and Panties, you know, it wasn't what any record company would have designed.
Yeah.
It was the biggest selling album of the year, you know. They let these people do things in a way that other areas of media and entertainment don't let people do things. So, you know.
Well, all of this is contained in this fantastic book. And I have to say, it is, I'm sure you've read some of Dave's other books, enormous amounts of insight, enormous amounts of wisdom, huge quantities of very entertaining and original stories, all true, and theories, thousands of theories that when you read them, you just immediately think, that's true, and I never thought of it, and I shall adopt that and pass it off as my own. It's all in there, and as are the copies of his other three books too, and Dave will be very, very happy to sign them. So it just remains for me to say thank you very, very much for coming on this evening. Wonderful to see you. Thanks. And to thank, again, David Hepworth. Thank you.
Mark Allen.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.